All right, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Whoa, that was loud as that was bare loud. Did you just up your octaves or did what happened there, man?
I used that extra deep layered octave. I can do that. I can throw my voice as well.
Yeah, good man.
But well, yeah, was that really loud? Should I do it from here?
I don't know, man. I feel like when Flynn put his input volume up, yours went up as well.
Yours went up and yours too, actually.
That can't be right.
Yeah, on Zoom, yeah.
Right.
I thought it would just be mine.
No, anyway, I think we all sound pretty clear now. Anyway, but
okay,
Jim, you've been doing some actual sport this morning, haven't you?
Yeah, actual sport. I was happy enough to be taken down to Flex Fitness in Highgate, right next to your dad's flat, Flynn, and Joe Cattell. Shout out to him and Dino. Took me on the pads. And I realized how uncoordinated I was and how basically all that training that I did about 10 years ago is null and void. I'm starting from the ground up again, but it's good fun. I'm going to try and make a habit of it every Saturday morning, man. And you've been swimming, haven't you, Bissett? You've been up and down doing the old Michael Phelps.
Swimming a little bit, but I've been playing more pickleball than anything. Have you ever heard of pickleball?
What's that now? Sorry.
It's like a pickleball. It's a combination between like badminton, tennis, and I guess ping pong, isn't it? So it's like a little combination between all three. The rules are pretty similar to tennis, but you use like a bat that hasn't got springs on it, so it's not like wired. It's like just a paddle, really. And then
you hit a pickle,
yeah, the pickle Rick. Nah, it's like a ball that's got like holes in it, plastic, quite light. But it's quite heavy as well at the same time. And you play on like, usually play on like a hard court, but it's pretty sick game, man. Yeah. It's getting really big in the US. I think it's the fastest growing sport in America.
Are you sure you didn't dream that game? Cause that sounds like an absolute figment of your imagination. The ball's kind of heavy, but it's light and there's a spring, but there isn't. And then my mom was there. And she, yeah, I don't know if you're a.
I reckon naked.
I reckon I could get to like pro level if in a year if I like train really hard. I reckon like you'll see me on like the world pickleball courts.
This is what I'm thinking about the darts, man. I've been training like Rocky Balboa up in here. I'm gonna be the West Midlands amateur darts champion. You watch, man. Open weight class. I've actually been killing it. Like I've been training every day except for yesterday.
You had a 180 yet?
Nah, man. I've only hit one of them in my life, you know. I'm concentrating on finishing on the double. The main thing for me, man. I beat someone down the British Oak the other day, so up and away. But Pizzy beat me as well, so don't know.
I feel like we could do some sort of ball chat challenge here, seeing as you two got back into sports. I went for my first bike ride in about 8 months the day before yesterday.
Good, man.
I feel like there's some sort of challenge. Maybe I could do a race by the end of the year. You could spar someone. Or even have some sort of amateur bout.
No, I'm all right. You know.
We'll do a triathlon. We'll do like a 10-mile bike ride. Then we'll like get in the gym and we'll, I don't know, we'll fight each other. And then and then we'll play pickleball at the end.
Why is everyone ignoring darts, man?
Should be 10K
bike ride. First one round the world hitting doubles and then pickleball marathon for 35 minutes, however that fucking mad game goes.
All right. Should we get on with the preamble ramble? And this has been a sort of like, I don't know what it's been like over in the UK, but in the US, pretty much everyone's been talking about this. It's been in all the news channels and it's the, her name's escaping me, Valieva.
Yeah, that's right. First name was...
Carla?
Katerina. No, not Katerina. That's someone else.
Fuck no, we don't even know the poor girl's name.
Valieva's right.
Camilla. There you go. Camilla Valieva. And obviously she's... she had some doping, and I'll let Flynn, you go for it.
So I've got a few of the basic points here. So basically, we've got a 15-year-old figure skater who gave a sample to WADA back in December. Now, on February the 8th, WADA reported that the sample tested positive for trimetidazine, which I think is a heart medication. And the Russian anti-doping agency, they suspended her that day, but it was lifted the next day. The IOC and a few other bodies, they tried to appeal the lifting of the suspension, but CAS allowed her to compete based on 3 points. First one being her status as a protected person, as she's under 16. Second one being the delay in the testing of her sample. Remember, she gave the sample in December, didn't get the results till February. So she didn't get enough time to defend herself and give reasons why she'd be on this sort of medication. And then point three... the irreparable harm that would result to Valieva if she were prevented from competing in the event, then say later on she was cleared of taking these substances. So, you know, it could have ruined her career not letting her compete there. So the IOC have announced that the team event medal ceremony would not be held during the Beijing Olympics. That's one she, her and her team won gold for. Additionally, there'll be no flower or medal ceremony in the event that Valieva places in the top three. So they're allowing her to compete, but if she wins anything, they're not going to give anyone any medals until this is all sorted out.
Which is absolutely raving on the other competitors, isn't it, really? Do you know what I mean? They don't get their big shining moment because of this particular instance. And I was just getting in there just before Cynical Jim, so has his word on it. But she, and then she ended up doing her skate, her final round, which she went, I think she was in the lead going into that final final performance. And she was going around and she could barely stand on the ice. I think it was that bad. I think she had like six or seven times where she fell over or sort of like nearly fell over. And the commentators were just saying, like, this is completely out of character. Like, the last 2 years, she's been, basically been flawless. And whether she was on that drug and whether that drug, how much that helps her performance in figure skating, I don't know. But I think the fact is she's 15 and she's clearly been coerced by her coaching staff. And her parents, I suppose, they'll definitely know about it, won't they, as well? So I think the real villains of this piece are her team, like, and everyone surrounding her. So I think it was right that she was allowed to continue competing, but maybe I just don't really like the way everybody around it's handled it, because she's a child at the end of the day, isn't it?
I'm not actually going to be as cynical as you might expect. I completely agree with you. She's a 15-year-old. The people around her, her team, her family, they've got a duty of care to her that's obviously been secondary to winning a medal in this instance. I just don't agree with her being allowed to compete when she couldn't have won gold. Like, how much more damage is not competing going to do than this doping violation? Her name's already been sullied, or at least until this gets sorted out. And she went on there clearly not in the same mental state as she would otherwise have been. Like, they call her Miss Perfect, don't they? She's like Simone Biles, like, pre the last Olympics, you know, absolutely smashing it every time she goes out there. So I think as soon as the results came in from her December test, they should have just pulled her straight away, because there's no, what's the gain? What's the benefit in this? You've seen what happened. And the reports are that her coach and that was very cold to her after she got off the ice. To be honest, I don't know. I haven't seen any translations. I don't know what they were saying to each other. The body language between them didn't look particularly cold to me. But again, this is all up in the air. I do feel sorry for the girl, to be honest. It's a lot of pressure. But I think the IOC, they could have just handled it a lot better. They should have just pulled her straight away, drew a line under it. She's got plenty of time. So that's where I stand on it, really.
Her teammate, the one that I think she got silver medal, because obviously Russia got gold and silver. And her teammate, after her performance, I saw a few clips of her. Like, she was distraught. And apparently somebody translated it. She was saying to her coach, like, this isn't right. I never want to get on the ice again. And it is unclear about what she was particularly talking about, but it was immediately after her performance. Maybe it was down to after Valieva's performance. And I think it didn't seem clear to me whether she was talking about her teammate shouldn't have got the gold, she should have got the gold, or she was talking about what happened on the ice when Valieva came off. So it's if we're getting into the realms of conspiracy, would the Olympic Committee say, you know, look, she's got to take a fall? I doubt it. Would ROC make her take a fall just to protect their kind of reputation?
Would that protect them, or how would that change anything? I don't.
Yeah, I saw this come up about the her taking a fall, but I wasn't sure what the benefit was.
Yeah, like, surely if she smashes off the event, it's just better. Even if she doesn't win the gold, the team and the Russian Olympic Committee could be like, yeah, we absolutely donned it. Let's just wait until these test results come back and then we'll go from there. There's no harm. But she capitulated on the ice, it looked like to me. And when she got off, she looked like she was barely holding it together. It's like you say, she's a kid. But at the same time, Olympic competition. And let's bear in mind, we're all trying to pretend like the Russians are being bare harsh to their kids. But let's be honest, this happens with every top level country that competes in the Olympics. What we're seeing is that political slant to things, because we're in the Western world and they're over there. it's all part of that kind of game. I just feel sorry for her, really, and I hope it doesn't damage her career from this point on.
She knows what she did. She gets no sympathy from me, lads.
Yeah, fuck it, man. Forget her.
And
filthy drug cheat.
It was pretty... I think the fact it was in China, I don't think there was much, like... I can't see the Chinese fans, like, booing. And to be honest, I don't think there's many fans that are in the building anyway. I think it's just mainly, like, family and like...
They were cheering her on. Exactly. When she fell over, they were clapping and cheering her. It was, like, quite heartwarming, really, even though she buckled, like, 3 more times after that. But it's not really, you know... They were being, like, nice to her.
Did you guys see the quad jump that she landed? First ever woman in the Olympics to land a quad jump. So it looked like you jump up in a straight line and you spin. You do 4 complete spins and then you do some sort of trick while you're doing it. So she dropped the first ever women's quad jump at the Olympics, and then about like 10 seconds later, she dropped the second one. It was incredible.
I've done a few of those myself, mate, when I'm out on the ice skating around. Blades of glory, kid.
All right, let's move on to the footy talk then, and we'll do a little bit of a Prem roundup. And we had the first Champions League last 16 fixtures as well, so we'll go through those. Arsenal shook off a dry January in which they only managed a single goal in 5 games that resulted in them being knocked out of both the FA and Carabao Cups with an away win at Wolves. They somehow managed to get over the line after Martinelli was sent off for one of the most bizarre red cards you are likely to see this season. Did either of you catch this red card incident?
Did he get two yellows in a row really quickly?
Yeah, in one phase of play. So he's obstructed the opposing player from taking a throw-in, and then the ball's gone over him and he's ran and fouled the player that the ball's gone to. I've never seen anyone get two yellows like that before. And I thought the second one was probably a yellow. The first one, I thought that was very, very harsh, man. But I suppose if you're blatantly obstructing play like that, then I can see the argument for it. It was just unusual to me.
Yeah, and I think there was a lot of pundits were saying that the referee shouldn't have really booked him for two separate offences in one moment. Do you know what I mean? Because isn't that part of the reason why you play an advantage? Is because you're gonna book him at the end of the play, end of the phase of play. So how can you book somebody for two separate incidents in the same phase of play? It doesn't really make sense to me, but...
If you commit two offences in that phase of play, I think like the referee might have grounds there. It didn't... When I seen it, I was like, "Right, that's fucked, man. That's really harsh." But then I thought to myself, he has actually done two things that are maybe not both a bookable in my opinion, but I could see how he got booked for those two things. Like if the time between each incident was further, I could see it.
And if the rule book backs him up, Flynn's going to be, you know, he's going to be saying then, yeah, he should have got sent off. Because you know what Flynn's like? He's going to go by the rule book, man.
Go on,
company
Flynn.
Company man over here. I'm going to have to consult the rule book there today and just make sure we're all clear on this. But if it's against the rules, it's against the rules. Is there a precedent for this, though? Has this ever happened before? 2 yellow cards in one phase of play?
Not to my memory. I reckon he probably has, but... in the Premier League, I don't think there's been many moments. I think Arteta was like clearly like fuming about it, to be fair. But Arsenal's performances on the pitch, I mean, you, Jim, we were talking about Arsenal prior to getting on the pod. And what did you say? They've won 5 of the last 7, was it? Or something like that. And obviously they got Brentford today. They're 3 games in hand over West Ham with only 3 points behind. They're looking like, you know, one of the favourites to get that fourth position, really. Maybe even third. Catch Chelsea in third.
Of the last 5, they've won 3, drew 1, lost 1. And as you say, 3 games in hand over West Ham, who sit just above them. And today, we'll probably get onto this in a bit, Brentford, they've got the worst form in the league, 4 losses and 1 draw from the last 5. So it's looking good for Arsenal to avenge that early season loss, that unexpected one. So, and we were talking about Arsenal getting relegated then. How quick did we jump the gun on that one, man? Arsenal have really, and Arteta, Martinelli, Smith Rowe, all the boys, they have actually turned it around and looking like the top 6 team that they have been for the last 5 or 6 years, really.
What a famously bad ball chat take. They don't come around very often,
mate,
do they?
We're ruthlessly horrible at picking things, aren't we, man?
And United back to winning ways under Ranić, and they sneak up into 4th as of the start of play today, I believe, with a home win against Brighton Tuesday. Obviously, Ronaldo back on the score sheet. But, you know, I was just looking through Ralph Ranić's sort of his immediate tenure, so his current tenure as manager, and just going through the sort of games that they started off. For me, it might be the easiest first 10 games we've ever seen from a Premier League manager. They beat Crystal Palace in their first game, didn't they? I think that was his first game in charge, or was he sort of like, you know, in the stands or watching over? So they played Palace, Norwich, Newcastle, Burnley, Wolves, Villa, Brentford, West Ham, Burnley, Southampton, and then Brighton. Like, there's no Liverpools, no Chelsea's.
Except for West Ham. West Ham's the only trouble one in there, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, I know Southampton have been on a good run of form. Obviously, I think Villa were sort of, that was maybe like Gerrard's fifth, maybe, or sixth game in charge. So, and they were in a good form there. Obviously got beat by Wolves at home, 1-0. But, you know, generally, that if somebody said to you, like, these are your first 10 games in charge, like, you're going to lap that up. But once again, you can only beat what's in front, yeah. But have they been doing that well? You know, you'd expect a Man United manager, you know, coming in with the players they've got at the disposal with Ronaldo there, maybe they should be in a better position than they currently are.
Every time I turn on any kind of review on Sky Sports or anything, I feel like it's been the same conversation for about 5 years with United. This isn't good enough for United. They should be doing better. This Man United, one of the biggest clubs in the world, blah, 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 blah. They're not on that level anymore. So is this... We're still associating it with Fergie, aren't we, man? They haven't been that team for a long, long time. So for me, yeah, losing to Wolves, not the best one. Drawing to Villa. I think, were they 2-0 up in that game as well?
Yeah, I think they were, yeah.
Yeah, so like they're a top four team now. When's the last time they legitimately contested for the Premier League title? It's been since Mourinho, they finished second. Ali, they finished second as well, but they weren't really like competing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's pre-Guardiola times, isn't it? Like, since Guardiola's been at City, I don't think they've realistically been anywhere close to them. I think Liverpool, obviously, they won it. And then they've been the nearest challengers, really. So it's interesting to see, you know, whether he stays there or whether he becomes that caretaker position at the end of the season and they get somebody else in. But, you know, there's been a lot of high caliber and well-respected coaches that have gone there now since Fergie left. And really haven't matched the sort of expectations of the board and expectations of the fans, to be honest. So is it going to have to be a case of a little bit similar to Arsenal, where they come to the realisation that, you know, after the sort of a very successful period, it's difficult on the come down, isn't it? For like the expectations of the fans to sort of level off. Kind of similar with what happened to Leicester, because I think Leicester, they expect a certain sort of position, a certain challenge every year now. When really they were close to getting relegated, won the Premier League, you know, so they should be happy to take what they can get, really. Just sort of surviving in the Premier League, I think, is good for them. But, you know, some people just want too much, don't they? But the honeymoon period is well and truly over for Stevie G, don't you think? Only one win in their last six Premier League matches since beating Norwich before Christmas. They've got Watford and Brighton to play next, and then inform Southampton, who think have only lost one in the last 10. And obviously they go to Villa Park. Where do we think Villa really can realistically can finish this season?
You'd say top half of the table would be nice for them, wouldn't it? Really, I mean, I know they've got the dons in like Coutinho and the lads, but like realistically, after the honeymoon period is over, like you say, where that's going to level off. You can't keep up that level of performance, especially with the amount of competition that's in the Premier League. I'd say top 10 would be nice for them. Is that realistic for them? Let's have a look at the table now. So they currently sit in 11th with 24 games played. Out of the last five, they've lost two, drawn two, won one. I'd say top 10 would be nice for them.
I think that's doable. It still feels like there's some sort of heat behind him, even though it seems to be plateauing a little bit, the whole honeymoon period thing. It does feel like there's some serious heat. I reckon they could easily do top 10.
Yeah, I think it has to be realistic, doesn't it? I don't think they're going to challenge for what would the Europa Conference League, which is what, 7th or 8th place now. I forget that the whole extra European competition things sort of I haven't really adjusted to yet. I think interestingly, the Celtic coach, is it Postecoglou or something like that? His name's something like that anyway. But they were saying that he could become the first coach to get knocked out of all three competitions in one season. Because I think they were in the qualifiers for the Champions League, got knocked out of that. Then obviously they been knocked out of the group stages of the Europa League, dropped down into the Europa Conference League. And then they got beat by the Norwegian champions, who people were jokingly said that Google couldn't even be asked to find their badge. Their crest. Nah, it's like, they're called like Strømsgodset or something like that. No, not Strømsgodset.
Yeah, the old Strømsgodset boys. I know them well,
mate. Norwegian.
While you're doing that, as a quick sidebar, because unusually today, we're doing this podcast on a Saturday afternoon, and obviously all the Premier League games are going on. Burnley, who currently sit in 19th, have given their survival chances a big boost by taking a 2-0 lead over Brighton. So they've got 22 games played, 3 in hand over Norwich, who sit just above them. Yeah, it's looking good for Burnley at the minute, but I think they're still in the first half, or maybe the second half's just started. But yeah, looking good for Burnley.
Good time to do a podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, live updates. That's amazing.
Yes, live updates for us 7 listeners. But and I probably won't edit this till Monday. It'll be too late. But they're called Bodo Glimt. Who's ever heard of that team? But elsewhere, there were wins for Liverpool. They beat Burnley. Newcastle's resurgence under Eddie Howe continues as they make it 3 wins on the bounce, although the loss of Kieran Trippier due to a broken foot will be a huge miss. And Fat Frank got his first Premier League win with Everton after gliding past Leeds 3-0. However, I do feel that there was a big slice of fortune to go along with that. And Wolves condemn Spurs to their 3rd defeat on the spin as they bounce back from their Arsenal defeat midweek. Do you think it's panic stations at White Hart Lane yet?
Always seems to be panic stations at White Hart Lane. I've been watching a couple of interviews with Conte, and I'm getting the feeling from him that he's thinking about moving on at the end of this season. I don't know for sure. He just seems like he's kind of hinting at it. And to be fair to him, he wants to be competing for the league and he wants to have the money to spend, and Tottenham are notoriously like small spenders. But what I wanted to throw back to you, what do you reckon would constitute success for Spurs this season?
It'd probably have to be the old Europa League again, or the Europa Conference League. They were in that and I think they got beat, didn't they? They're not even in the last 16 or the last 32, I think it is, with the Europa Conference League. But realistically, I feel like Tottenham feel like they're above that. But they're nowhere near the level that they need to be at to challenge for the Premier League. So they're in kind of like this sort of like nomadic state at the minute.
Yeah, it's the same with Arsenal, man. It's like, out of all the good teams, they're the shit ones. Like Arsenal and Tottenham, they're the shit good teams. They're nowhere near competing for winning the league. They're never going to win the Champions League anytime soon. And the expectation is still there, regardless of that reality. So I would say they're commensurate teams in terms of their fans' expectations.
Yeah, I think it's only going to get harder for them to get where they need to be now when you've got big money teams like Newcastle and Villa working their way up.
Yeah, definitely. And the stats are quite interesting on Nuno Espirito Santo, who obviously started the season off as manager. He went 17 games, 8 wins, 2 draws, 7 losses, had a win percentage of 47%. So as it stands, Conte's only had 2 more games and he's had 2 more wins. So he's had 19 games coached. 10 wins, 3 draws, 6 losses. So a very, very similar record with a win percentage of 52%. So only slightly above what Nuno was when he got sacked. Do you think that Conte's reputation perhaps gives him that extra few games before they start to think about the chop?
Absolutely. I think the only difference between Espirito Santo de Culo and Conte is just that. Conte is viewed as a big coach, man. He's been to Italy. He donned it off at Chelsea. And this leads back to Spurs fans and the board's expectations. We're a big club. We deserve a big coach. And if the coach, even if he's doing a decent job, doesn't fit the optics, which is a word I've picked up from Succession and I can't stop fucking saying, if it doesn't fit that mold of the perception of the team they want to be, then they're going to be shown the door much quicker. And I think Conte is definitely going to have like probably 6-10 extra games than a less favoured manager would have.
Yeah, and finally, before we move into the Champions League roundup, which will involve Man City, obviously, as well, and Liverpool. But I think in the Premier League, Man City looking imperious yet again, aren't they? And, I think we could be looking at one of the greatest Premier League teams of all time under Guardiola, and the team is building there. And I don't see them going away anytime soon. Obviously, they backed up with that with an emphatic win in the Champions League as well. Obviously, they beat Sporting 5-0, who I don't think are any sort of any mugs. Well, they can't be a mug if they got into the last 16 in Champions League tie. And they're beaten 5-0 in their own backyard in their Sports Direct third kits. Really breezed past them, you know, and effectively sealed their place in the quarterfinals. Two goals from Bernardo Silva on his return to the Estadio José Alvalade. Flynn's going to pick up on my my Portuguese there. And since he left Benfica, and they were obviously added to goals from Phil Foden, Mahrez. I think Mahrez is still their top goal scorer of the season. And then Sterling added a fifth. As Man City, you know, they basically took their foot off the gas, I think, after like 55 minutes, I think, with the fifth goal went in. And they just basically start preparing for the next round. But if you saw on the sidelines, Pep, he's an absolute psycho. He's like Michael Jordan levels of psycho. Like he was still like gesticulating to the players at 5-0, like telling them off for like not tracking back that extra yard. And like, it didn't celebrate, well, barely celebrated any of the goals. But I think that's why like he's coaching the best team in the world. And like, you know, we're doing what we're doing, isn't it?
Listen, he was talking to that team like they were 2-1 down, you know, and it was 10 minutes left to go, hammering the fuck out of this team in their own back garden. Did you see Silva's goal, the second one, you know, when the ball went up high and he's gave his shout to the nearest player and he's just, I don't know how he controlled that on the half volley, just glided, listen, guided it under the crossbar, slammed it home. What about Sterling's goal, man? FIFA, R1, all day, mate, top corner.
Dude. Finesse.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying to you. And here's the thing as well, how sick are Man City that, for me, they've basically got the Premier League locked. It's locked, isn't it, really? Like, unless something mad happens. And now he's just chasing the Champions League. This is what he's after. We know that's his goal, isn't it? Where his resources are being directed. Everyone else is just like, yeah, okay, they're basically going to romp the Premier League. Think about how good Liverpool are. And they're playing second fiddle. It's fucking mad. What an achievement, man.
And they've been doing it all without, like, an out-and-out striker for me. Do you know what I mean? I don't think Gabriel Jesus is a sort of like out and out striker. He's not a target man. He's more of a player that's going to play on the sort of shoulder of the defender, look to get into the gaps, you know, use his pace. But if Phil Foden's been playing that position, and obviously, you know, Gundogan last season played in that position a little bit. Kevin De Bruyne has played there. So he's just like, you know what I mean? He's got all this tool set. He's got this tool set that he can use. And he just fucking conducts, man. That's what he just... You know what I mean? Just,
yeah, can't miss
that side of the, that side of the orchestra can play for a little bit. You can play for a little bit and just spreads the goals around, man. He's just... and obviously, he spent a hell of a lot of money. No one's denying that. And I think a lot of people are saying, you know, Simon Jordan was on TalkSport. I think he was saying that, like, you know, he spent three times the amount of that that sort of Man United coaches have or that Klopp has. I think the point in question was he spent three times the amount of Klopp since he's been there. But at the end of the day, you need to use those resources and those tools to get results, don't you? And like Guardiola's the best in the business at doing it at the moment.
Why would you have one or two out-and-out strikers when you're implementing a system that brings your whole midfield to bear on the box? It's frightening when they're like, you don't know what's going to happen next. And you know, all of them can score goals. You know, all of them can bring out that crucial pass. When you said Riyad Mahrez was their top scorer, I was like, what the fuck? But it makes complete sense, man. It makes complete sense because they're all interchangeable on that level. Sorry, Flynn, that's the last time I'm going to cut you off, I promise.
No, I was just going to say, he spent three times more than everyone else. He spent heaps more than everyone else. But that doesn't matter if you're not able to lead them properly. And that's why they're great. They're 5-0 up and he's still grafting. He's still putting in the work. That's why they could be the best ever. Do you reckon that's the case? Do you think they could be the best Premiership team ever?
I think he came out, didn't he? And I think if he hasn't won, it might not matter whether he wins it or not in the next 2 years, but I'm sure he came out at the start of the season and said that, you know, he's going to leave in 2 years, regardless of whether they win a Champions League or not. Be interesting to see what happens if they haven't won it this season and at the end of the last season, you know, we'll see what happens, man. But I'd like him to stay because, I you know, he's the best coach in the world at the minute. He has to be considered. Obviously, and his old team, Bayern Munich, were not so fruitful in their last 16 game. They drew to Red Bull Salzburg, which is really a defining moment, I think, for them. in the last 16, as they were really just moments away from topping, you know, a European heavyweight such as Bayern Munich. But Kingsley Coman's late strike cancelled out 20-year-old Junior Adamu's opener. And Salzburg are flying in the Bundesliga, Austrian Bundesliga. And they progressed from a group that included Germans Wolfsburg and prolific Europa League winner Sevilla. Head coach Matthias Jassler will be fairly unheard of to many football fans. And at the age of just 33, he has been bouncing around that Red Bull's development system for a few years before he was finally given the opportunity at Salzburg. And, you know, they look set to make life uncomfortable for Bayern in the second leg without, of course, the need to worry about the away goals, because that's been scrapped for this year, hasn't it?
See, that's where you need to be, man, in that Red Bull development coaching system, innit? Knocking about. Give him a shot at Salzburg. Like, anyone listening, I've not called anyone a nonce in this episode because I'm conscious of Bissett's career opportunities, man. But yeah, I didn't know they'd scrap the away goals. I didn't know. Why did they do that?
I think it's just something they've been talking about for a few years. Yeah, so they got rid of it this year. I think, you know, it's one of them. A lot of teams were moaning about it when it was there, because, like, obviously the team that's on the losing end of it's going to be like, away goals shouldn't count. But now they're not there. I saw pundits moaning about the Real Madrid game, where they were saying that Real Madrid were basically like playing for a 0-0 draw. Yeah, because the away goals don't count anymore, what's the point in going forward and risking it where you can just try and get a 0-0?
If you don't concede away from home, you're fucking quids in anyway, aren't you? Do you know what I mean? As long as you don't concede, I don't know. It's hard to say, because it adds an extra dimension of drama. But on a baseline fairness level, it doesn't really make that much sense, because if you go 2-0 down at home, you're basically fucked, aren't you? So I can understand why they got rid of it.
All right, Jim, you're gonna do the last two Champions League games, yeah?
Yeah, I do now, man. So Liverpool struck a healthy lead in their round of 16 fixture against Inter Milan midweek. Both teams got off to a roaring start. Mane missed a close-range header and a bicycle kick. Trent came close with the free kick of his own. And you'll have to help me with the pronunciation here. Çalhanoğlu,
yeah, Turkish.
Yeah, he hit the underside of the bar for Inter Milan. And that was all within the first half an hour. Edin Dzeko, all-time darn striker for me. His tidy finish in the 59th minute was disallowed for offside. And as the game wore on, I couldn't help but think that our boy Lukaku would have put the game to bed already for Inter Milan. However, it was Liverpool who broke the deadlock in the 74th minute with Firmino's perfectly weighted header from the corner. Perisic came close to equalising 5 minutes later for Inter. But it was our boy, big Mo Salah, who latched onto a loose ball in the box with 8 minutes to go for Liverpool's second and the final goal. And I'd be surprised if the Reds let this go at Anfield, you know. What do you think?
Yeah, Mo Salah back in his natural habitat, innit? Nah, I can't see it. I reckon Liverpool, it's one of them, man. They've just been so consistent at doing it over the last few years in the Champions League. Klopp has become somewhat of a, like, Champions League expert, really. Do you know what I mean? He just knows how to manage these types of games. And everything seems to fall into his lap, a little bit unlike Guardiola. You know, he hasn't had the same amount of success that Klopp has had in the Champions League. So, I just think Liverpool, you can't really see them not moving into the quarterfinals now. Once again, could they get to their third Champions League under Klopp? Obviously, won one, lost one. That'd be remarkable, really. He's only been there since 2015. So to have a 50% strike rate for finals would be absolutely incredible.
I wonder what the difference is between them. Because Guardiola and City, I think they're the superior team in the Premier League. But like, why do Liverpool tend to do better? It's a bit of a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's bizarre. Maybe it's you do play against teams that have obviously different tactical styles and they have different philosophies, different ways of approaching the game. So maybe he's better at handling that different side of the game in terms of like playing teams like from Italy, from Germany, that may have different tactical styles. But that'd be saying that he's a better tactician than Pep. And I don't really agree with that. It's really difficult to say. I do think there's an element of luck to it as well, but only a small element of luck. Because I do think, you know, the highest, you know, caliber coaches in the world, you know, at the end of the day, you make your own luck by putting in the hard yards, really, and sort of just being the best at what you do in it. So
just to go back to that Turkish dude, I think it's Çalhanoğlu. I think that
Chalanoyu.
Chalanoyu, I think that G at the end's got a thing on top of it, and I'm pretty sure that's silent in Turkish.
Good man. See, we need our local linguist, Flynn, absolutely smashing it. For the last game of the Champions League roundup, PSG versus Real Madrid, superstars galore. And my main takeaway from the game was, listen, Kylian Mbappe does my head in, you know. I don't know why, but he does. I just don't like him.
He looks a little bit like Kermit the Frog, don't he? I think, is that why?
I've got nothing against Kermit or his associates. But I don't know. I think it's because the sheer weight of hype. Him and Haaland, I weren't quick to jump on the hype train, you know what I mean? But in this game the other night, Real Madrid could not handle this kid, you know. He was a constant threat down the left-hand side. He should have had a penalty in the 17th minute for a shove in the back from Carvajal. He forced a strong save from Courtois early in the second half. He drew another challenge in the box from Carvajal in the 60th. This time the penalty was given. The great man Lionel Messi stepped up with a disappointing effort by his standards. Courtois still needed to be on point for the save though. And it was looking like a scoreless draw until Neymar, of all players, sprung Mbappe free on the left-hand side with a lovely back heel, taking out two Madrid players in one fell swoop. And your boy Mbappe, he was unstoppable from then. He dropped the step over, drove between two defenders and guided his shot in between Courtois' legs for the last gasp winner. Those are done moves by anyone's standards. And what else can you say? I don't care if he looks like Kermit the Frog, man.
That's obviously in American sports, they use this term clutch, don't they? Like, you know, being elite in the moment when you need to be. Do you know what I mean? Like a three-pointer on the buzzer. Those sort of levels. Tom Brady throwing the touchdown pass like in the last few seconds of the game. And like, this is what that was, man. He was on those levels, man. To pull out that sort of movement and that sort of skill at the sort of like the last gasp minute of the game. And I was being slightly facetious in the group chat when I was saying that he was sort of like gently lifting the crown off Messi's head. But
I love that one.
To be honest, it did feel like that. And I think L'Équipe, this obviously the sports newspaper, they gave him a 3 out of 10, Messi. So they were like proper going in on him, man, about his performance. And then Mbappe's there once again, still only what, like 22, 23. Has he got like over 100 goals for PSG now or something? I don't know what he's on, but like, you know, he's just killing it, man. And he's one of those players that we're going to be looking at in 5 years that are going to be like nailed on, like best top three players in the world for sure.
But you know, Messi, he was still doing bits, man. He was still bringing players, defenders into the middle of the park, releasing that crucial pass out to the wide players. Di Maria had a sick game as well. And PSG are a bit of a mad one where I'm not sure what the league standings are, but every time I see the highlights, it's like a fucking draw or 1-0, or it's not as if they're absolutely running up a one-sided league. Do you know what I mean? But then they do this in the Champions League. It's a bit of a weird one.
Yeah, I was just trying to find... So in the Champions League this season, he's got 5 goals and 6 assists in 7 appearances, which is mad stats. In league, he's got 12 goals and 9 assists in 22 games. And then in the Coupe de France, he's got 5 goals and 1 assist in 3 games. He's just a goal-scoring phenomenon.
Look, that's consistent. That's a nice spread across all things, isn't it? I would stop short of saying, because you never know what's going to happen. What, in 5 years, he might be the best, he might not. But yeah, he's definitely, by doing things like this in the Champions League, last gasp winners against Real Madrid, that's what you want from your top players, isn't it, realistically? And it can only help Messi be in there, you know, help him on the training pitch, telling him just little bits and bobs about the Gandalf of football, telling you what's what. Do you know what I'm saying? It's only ever going to help. So Messi being there, he might not be at his best in terms of his playing, but in terms of his philosophy and in terms of his experience, who's done more than Messi? It's just him and Ronaldo out there on their own. You know, it's invaluable. It must have been, that's worth every penny of his wages, that alone.
90 goals and 102 appearances for PSG and 24 goals and 53 appearances for France at the age of 23. Those are nuts stats. Do you know what I mean?
Sick.
Nuts. Right, Flynn, are you going to give us a Winter Olympics update? And possibly, if you can, an update on your sneaky little flights back to Brom to see your fancy woman?
No updates on the flights for now.
Don't put him on the spot like that, you cheeky cunt.
No updates in that regard. But Winter Olympics, lots of things are kicking off. Aside from all the drug scandals and you know, child exploitation, there's actually been some good news from the Olympics. Team GB are guaranteed a second medal as the women reach the curling final. So they may get silver or they may get gold. Norway currently leading the medal table with 15 golds. Denmark are second with 10, and the US are in third with 8. So it kind of makes you question, why are Russia bothering with all the doping if they're not even in the top three? Also, we've got Dutch speed skater Irene Roest. She's the first athlete to win individual gold at 5 Olympics, and that's summer and winter included. She also became the oldest Olympic champion in any skating discipline at age 35 and set an Olympic record at Beijing 2022. We'll move over to this dude from Norway. Johannes Thingnes Bø wins the men's biathlon mass start, earning Norway a record 15th gold. And it also makes him the king of these Olympics with 4 golds. So as you can see, it's all kicking off this winter.
He's like the Phelps of the Winter Olympics, isn't it? Never make my top 10 anyway. Fuck him.
I'm not sure who usually wins the Winter Olympics. Like, who's the country that comes in with the most golds or the most medals?
Just imagine where there's snow. I think they do all right, you know.
Like, Norway are leading. Norway are smashing it at the minute. They're on like 15 golds, 8 silvers, 12 bronzes, 35 total. Great Britain, as you said, only 1 medal. The same amount as Spain. That's disgusting, that is. Spain, like, they like never see snow at all.
No, but we don't have proper winter weather. It just rains a bit here. There's no events where it's like, put your rain mac on and go for a walk with the dog. You know, they're actually bobsleigh for jokes. They walk with skis and shit over there, man. It's in their genetics, isn't it? What can you do, man?
There's a lot of skiing in the north of Spain, not far from where I am in Barcelona. If you go a couple of hours north, you've got the Pyrenees Mountains. So yeah, I imagine at least some people are practicing it here. I don't think you get any skiing in the UK, do you? In Scotland, maybe.
Only up the Akers, mate, in Sparky. Or is it Tisley? The worst dry slope you've ever seen in your life, and you have to drive for an absolute shithole to get there.
Nice. The moulding champions there.
Oh. And you know what? I was watching the curling the other day, and all I could think was, how do you even get into that? Like, there was like young lads, like I think the Great Britain were playing like Russia or something. I think they won. They must have. I think that's what you're saying in the curling. Did they win a medal or something?
They guaranteed one. They're in the final.
Okay, the guaranteed one. And I was just thinking, like, how on earth do you get into that? Like, who do you need to know, and where do you go to learn how to curl?
Well, that's the one with the brushes, isn't it?
Yeah, where they set the stone sort of glides down, and then they just start like brushing. And then like they start panicking if they think it's going to go too far away from the circle. They start like doing it the opposite way or something. I don't know. It just makes no sense to me.
Could you imagine someone like Anthony Mack, shout out, coming up to you and going, hey, do you fancy coming curling?
I would be more tempted to do that than go down Sparky or Baths, to be fair.
It's always good to see me and my mum. I can have a tenner so I can go curling with my mum.
so you're not coming now. I'll just have some money so I can go then. No, sir.
Big up Annie Mac if you ever listen to this, man.
This is that I love, Annie. Yeah.
It was good to see him, man. All right. Should we do the old Super Bowl review? The Super Bowl.
Yeah.
That made me crease when somebody wrote like, oh, who's gonna win the Super Bowl? And Busy was like Hedwig. That was crazy.
Man. That is so... I forgot about that until you just said it. So I know you're going to have a comprehensive roundup anyway, but I did have a few questions for you because I managed to watch the highlights and I think I've got the main points of the game down. It was, I have to say, it wasn't choresome watching the highlights, but I don't know how people watch a full game. So I'm going to lead off. We'll do one question at a time. You hit me with your responses and we'll go from there. So I think the most crucial point in the game was the holding call that led to the winning touchdown. And to me, especially when you consider other things that happened in the game that didn't get called. I thought it looked a little bit soft. What did you think, Bissett?
Yeah, and to go back to what you were saying about it not being very watchable, the highlights. To be honest, the game itself wasn't that watchable. It wasn't really a classic Super Bowl. And obviously, there's been games, you know, across the season, in the regular season and in the playoffs, that have been way, way more exciting. To be fair, generally, on the whole, the playoffs have been really interesting. And I think this was probably one of the less exciting games of the whole sort of like playoff series in total. But that holding call in particular, I think, yeah, bang on, extremely soft. And I think the commentators played it down slightly. But I thought the officiating throughout the whole game was like slightly odd. There was an egregious offensive pass interference call that was missed on Jalen Ramsey when T. Higgins scored. I think it was right at the start of the second half. For me, that call gets called every single day in the regular season. But I felt that, like, potentially because it's a Super Bowl and it's like the biggest stage, the spectacle, all the eyes are on it, that the refs didn't throw it. But like, he literally, like, as the ball was coming over to him, Jalen Ramsey is one of the best cornerbacks in, well, probably the best cornerback in the league, one of the best defensive players in the league. He sort of like, T. Higgins sort of like grabbed his face mask and sort of pulled him away at the crucial moment.
That's what I'm thinking about. That's exactly what I'm talking about. He grabbed his face and dragged him across. And obviously they're moving at such speed that it's like hard to catch in real time. But I was like, how does that not get called? And then the holding call gets, it did seem like they were officiating to the occasion rather than the game.
Yeah, but then the holding call in question, I can't remember the Bengals defensive player that it was on. Obviously Cooper Kupp, who was just like running the show second half, and he ended up being the MVP. You know, I don't think he really impeded Kupp. He didn't really, he sort of got round him, and I thought he made a great play. He sort of like batted away the ball. Obviously, look, Stafford was just targeting Kupp in that sort of in that last quarter. The connection between them was absolutely amazing. And then they had the play where the penalties offset. Kupp caught the end zone before he finally caught what was to be the winning touchdown. But to be honest, I think the game itself was won by defensive play in the second half. Particularly, I think Joe Burrow wasn't sacked at any point in the first half, but in the second half, I think he was sacked 7 times. So like the LA Rams defense came true in the end. Aaron Donald, potentially, he's going to be one of the greatest defensive players of all time. Now he's got that Super Bowl ring as well, adds to his legacy. He stopped a certain first down on 3rd and 1 and then pressured Burrow in the resulting turnover, which basically gave him the win right there. Possibly had a case for him being MVP and not Kupp, but let's not deny how good Kupp was in that fourth quarter.
And I've just looked at the notes here, and I got the impression from the highlights that it was Chase for the Bengals. What position is he?
Wide receiver.
Wide receiver. And I'm almost certain that they said he hadn't dropped the pass all season. Is that true?
I watched the highlights back. It was Tyler Boyd. So Tyler Boyd. Still impressive. Another wide receiver. But yes, it was Tyler Boyd. That was the first pass he's dropped all season. Doesn't get as many targets as Chase. But like, you have to, you know, I think Chase has had a remarkable season. He's had this breakout year as a rookie wide receiver, came straight into that that lineup with Joe Burrow, and they both played together at college at LSU. So, you know, I think that connection's just been there from the offset. But yeah, he has had a few troubles with catches, but he's also made some really huge plays and got a lot of touchdowns this season. So either way, like, he's had a remarkable season. Tyler Boyd, like, I didn't even know about that. Like, that is unbelievable. I'm not sure I wonder how many wide receivers, like, let's say over sort of, you know, 50 catches haven't dropped one in the whole season, including the playoffs. I don't think there's many, man.
Now, when I heard the commentator say that, I was like, that is fucking next. But I'm sure it was Chase who pulled out a mad one-handed catch in the game that I thought was very impressive. Again, taking into account their speed, the way they're moving. They're not just running fast. They're looking over their shoulder. They're anticipating where the defenders come in to them. I don't know what like the nomenclature is for the defensive end, tight end, whatever. Just big muscular fella who's running after you. But it is very impressive to see people do things like that at high speed in the moment, in the big game. another pivotal point, another pivotal moment in the game. Odell Beckham Jr., son of David Beckham, as we all know, he went off in was it the second or the third quarter?
Yeah, was I think it, it was. Was it? I think it might have been the second quarter. I think it was before halftime, wasn't it?
Yeah, he took a bad step, and you could see his knee just went, didn't it? How much did that injury affect the game for you?
I think when it happened, it felt like a huge moment. I think it certainly gave Bengals an opportunity back into the game. Obviously, OBJ scored on his first target and got a touchdown. And we said last week, I think he's grown into that wide receiver two position with the Rams after making the move in November, signing a one-year deal. And I think, you know, Rams built that team. They were like, we want to win this year. Like with the players they brought in Von Miller, they brought in OBJ. I think it was time for them to win. And obviously they weren't getting the run game going. Cam Akers, I think he's only played five times this year because he was coming back from injury. But he only managed 21 yards on 13 carries. So there was no run game for the Rams. They were without Tyler Higbee, their sort of like tight end that's been ever present really throughout the whole regular season. He's been really, really good. But they were utilizing their other tight end, I think Bryson Hopkins. And also they had Van Jefferson and Ben Skowronek, who I've not really heard much about, but he was another wide receiver along with Van Jefferson. So they were getting them involved as well. So he managed really well, Stafford, to be fair. He managed the situation really, really well. And ultimately, OBJ's injury didn't come back to haunt him. And, you know, it was nice to see the pure relief on OBJ's face. I don't know if you saw that, but obviously he's been desperate to win a Super Bowl ring. You know, he became very famous for his one-handed catches and just his general sort of like play. You know, he throughout his career has been considered like one of the best wide receivers in the league at one point or another. And then obviously Aaron Donald, like he had tears of joy at the final play when they handed the Rams the title. So it just shows you how much these sports people put in to you know, winning this accolade, really. And I think ultimately LA Rams were the team and they deserved it. And they got over the sort of the potential hurdles that were put in front of them.
Yeah, having such a renowned player like Odell Beckham being injured in the final, it reminded me of when Ronaldo got done in the Euros. You know what I mean? Like, you know that he, for me to hear his name, it must mean he's a big deal in the NFL, you know? So I did feel for him on that level. And it's a credit to the Rams that they were able to overcome his injury, especially with everything you're just saying there, not getting the running game going, et cetera, et cetera. But one of their greatest strengths was, as you've been talking about, Stafford. My man looked like Predator 2, fucking laser beam on his shoulder, zeroing in on everything. And I just wanted to ask you, this might sound like a broad question considering he's just won the Super Bowl, but where do you rank him in the league right now? Was this run to the Super Bowl kind of like a spike in an average-ish career? Or could this be the heir to the Brady throne? Sacrilege, I know, but we've got to ask it, man.
Well, he's had a bit of an interesting career, really. He was being paid like an elite quarterback when he was in Detroit with the Lions, but they've been terrible. And I don't think that's down to him at all. And quite clearly, it's not down to him because in his first season, he's gonna win the Super Bowl with the Rams. But obviously, the Lions couldn't build a team around him. That didn't really enable his qualities to shine. He was there for 11 years, and I think like in the abyss, definitely in the abyss, in the sort of sporting abyss. And he didn't manage a single playoff win. I think he only managed to get there three times in 11 years. So, you know, lo and behold, he's gone to Rams. He's won it. And we spoke about him before the start of the season, we were talking about the trade between Lions and the Rams. Obviously, Matt Stafford going one way and Jared Goff going the other. And another famously bad take on the ball chat. I said, I'm not sure how much of an upgrade Stafford is on Goff. But yeah, you know, look, they've gone and won a Super Bowl with him, with the addition of, you know, Von Miller, OBJ. They already had Cooper Kupp, who is considered like a very good wide receiver there. They've got Jalen Ramsey on defense. They got Leonard Floyd on defense, amongst others. So they were primed and built, ready to challenge for a Super Bowl. But let's not take anything away from Stafford. He's gone from a poor organization where he hadn't the tools around him. And then he's gone to the Rams, and he's donned it, really. He's been in the moment. He's made sure that he's used all his tools around him, And I think he's managed the situation really well. All I'm saying is, you know, he had a lot of ammunition in the Rams. So it'd be interesting to see what he does from here. Obviously, they've got a burgeoning young coach in Sean McVay, and he's been given the keys to the Super Bowl, basically. But he's done the business. And, you know, I think we'll see where he is from here. But just to point out, Joe Burrow, right? And obviously he's the loser on the end of this the Super Bowl. So you don't really talk about the losers as much as you do the winners. And you know it's them that stay in history. But he was the most sacked quarterback in the league this year. So you know just to put that into perspective, like this guy managed to drag his team to a Super Bowl, and you know was within a field goal of tying it and potentially winning it. And yet he's possibly got one of the worst offensive lines in the Super Bowl. So he gets no protection. So just and to compare him to another quarterback that had no protection, who had a lot of quality, Andrew Luck, who had to retire at 29. And Jim, we've spoke about before about the importance of having those players in front of you and why Tom Brady's been successful all his career. It's because he's had the guys in front of him that protect him, and they give him time to throw the ball. And obviously he's not getting smashed up by, you know, these huge defensive ends all the time. Whereas Joe Burrow, you know, he could be out of the league very soon, similar to Andrew Luck, if Bengals don't get that protection. But can you imagine what this guy might do if he does get players to protect him?
I like that take, you know, Bissett, because it's kind of like a sick keeper in the Premier League, like playing with the shit back four in front of him, still pulling off done saves, but not getting the credit and not getting the trophies because the organisation around him isn't up to par with his abilities, man. I like that little shout out there, you know, that's nice. But yeah, it's a shame because he's got fucking giants running into him, smashing him to the floor. And, you know, it's a short career anyway, maybe even shorter if you haven't got the offensive line in front of you. So it's a shame, really. I hope they do sort it out, man, because if he is as good as you're saying he is, then surely he deserves something. One ring, it's not too much to ask, is it?
Nah, not to blow my own trumpet, but I was only a point off the final score. I predicted to be 24-21 and ended up being 23-20.
Good man. Bits, mate.
Credit where it's due, man. We do some bad calls, but sometimes we do some good ones as well. Did you
just
manage to catch
one good call?
just one good call
in a year of ball chat. We've done it, lads. Let's hang up these headphones.
Yeah. Fuck this. Should we just bounce, man? Bissett called it at a point. Yeah.
But Flynn, did you manage to watch any of it? I know it was probably on like early hours of the morning, but the halftime show was absolutely sick, I thought. Like probably one of the best I've ever seen.
Yeah, India put it on, man. I was like, yeah, this is pretty sick, actually. I'm glad they didn't do like new shit tunes, man. They just did all the bangers, like early 2000s, mid 90s. No, 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 no. You know it, man.
And then 50, who was it? 50 dropped out as well, like a bat, like hanging like a bat, just came in. Like 50, bro, man.
No, listen, I don't know if you remember, but D12 brought out the tune My Band back in the day. And it's Bizarre, who's the fat one from D12. And he parodied that bit from the 50 Cent in the club video. And 50 Cent had put on so much weight that I thought it was Bizarre when he first dropped down there, man. And I was like, bro, you need to like lay off the shrimp or whatever you're doing, because this is a bad look, man. Wear a hoodie or something. He's still in good shape, but he's not in his prime anymore. Oh, Curtis Jackson, shout out to the God.
I remember your big brother playing that album on repeat for about a decade, Jim.
Son, I've been playing it on repeat for like probably two decades. I fucking love that shit, man. Love 50 Cent. But yeah, it was a nice little, it was like a real nostalgic one for me. And I thought it was actually, to go back to what you were saying, Bissett, about the game itself, how it might not have been the best quality, the most exciting, because I heard way more about the halftime show than I did about the result itself. So
says a lot, doesn't it, really? But we'll move on to the five things you might have missed. And then we've got the combat sports review and preview. I'm looking forward to getting Jim's perspective on that, on the fight that's coming up later. Number one, James Harden and Ben Simmons were involved in a blockbuster trade between the Brooklyn Nets and the Philadelphia 76ers. Simmons is going to join fellow superstars Kyrie Irving when he can play and Kevin Durant when he's not injured in Brooklyn to continue their attempt to win the team's first ever NBA championship. Simmons, on the other hand, will team up with Joel Embiid, who looks a little bit like Joe Barr. Check him out. As they continue their bid for a championship this season, sitting a couple of places above Brooklyn in the Eastern Conference. And I think basketball is a sport unlike a lot of other sports. in terms that, and I think this trade in particular really amplified the prevalence of like player power in the NBA, especially in the James Harden situation, as he was like, he was in Houston and he was like, all right, I don't want a beer anymore. So he went to Brooklyn and then apparently he's fell out with Kyrie over his vaccination status. And like, obviously he can't play in New York at the minute. And what, he can't play in any states that don't accept the unvaxxed, basically. So he can only play in states that where they allow unvaxxed in the building, essentially. So I think he's fell out over that. And then, you know, he's forced another move. So it's like, basketballers can basically like, they can go wherever they want, and it like it feels like they've got more control than the owners. So what do you think about, like, I'll get Flynn's opinion on this first. What do you think about athletes having this much power, like, over basically, you know, having the sort of, having the owners like dick in a vice, basically, isn't it? You know what I mean? So they get the balls in a vice. Does this strike you as like an issue for like player power, and like, you know, could this sort of like feed its way into other sports potentially?
It strikes me as a good thing and a bad thing, because some sports play the athletes don't have enough power. We often talk about UFC and fighter pay, and if they were able to unionize and have some more power, it'd be better for the athletes, but maybe not so good for the sport as a whole. Though in regards to these basketball players having so much power, it seems like you've passed a limit where, so this dude who's not had the vaccine, he can only play a certain amount of games depending in what state these games are. If I was in charge of that team, I'd sack him off, and it wouldn't be a vaccine issue. It'd be like, look, I'm paying for you as much as I'm paying for anyone else, and you're only doing 50% of the work as the rest of the team. So it sounds like, yeah, the owners and the coaches are being treated like mugs here.
And I think this was big news, like, prior to the start of the season, that he came out and he was honest that he wasn't going to get the vaccine. He didn't believe that he needed to get it, or he didn't want to get it, whatever. I think people should have that choice. And I think the owners have gone about it the right way. I think he's on like a pay to play or whatever. So he's on that sort of contract. You know what I mean? I don't think he's on sort of like salary or whatever. Pay as you go kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. So pay as you play, innit? So that's basically what he's doing. So I don't really have an issue with that. But obviously, you know, James Harden's gone to Philly now, and he sort of had a little jibe at him. He was like there's players here that want to win. And I think that was a massive jibe at Kyrie, saying that basically, like, if you want to win an NBA championship, like, you have to get vaxxed.
Pussy talk, that is. Absolute pussy talk. No, because let's be honest, I didn't even consider that. If you take this guy on and you give him a contract and they're on fucking mega money in the NBA, that you are going to be getting half the games for twice the money, essentially. But if he is on a pay-to-play basis, then it kind of works out for everyone. And the issue of player power, I think the more power the athletes get, the better. Because look, it's a short window. Look at what they go through. They go through middle school, high school, college. Some of them go straight into the NBA, young men. A lot of them put all their eggs in one basket. They're from disenfranchised backgrounds, from shitholes, basically. Do you know what I mean? They're trying to make it out of the fucking, off the block and into the NBA. So as much power as they can get, as much money as they can get, I'm happy with that. Because listen, those fucking Monopoly men with the monocles, they're going to make money anyway. They're not the victims there. So, but again, the issue with the vax and all that's kind of separate, kind of muddies the water a little bit. But yeah, player power, I'm all for it, man.
See, if you've got one player who can only do half of the games, do you need to, as a coach, do you need to prepare for that? Do you need to set up two different sort of types of tactics in order to play? Do you see what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the Brooklyn Nets are in quite a unique position because they have got some talent there. Obviously, Kevin Durant's there. Andre Drummond. Is it Andre Drummond? The guy that I was watching the other night. I watched them against the Knicks. They came down from 28 points to beat the Knicks, and everyone's furious about the Knicks in New York at the minute. So they've got some talent on that squad. So they're managing without him in those key games. And obviously, while KD is injured as well, because he's, you know, probably the best player in the league. So they know that when he comes back, they're going to have a chance. So they've been sort of like, you know, I think they went on like a nine game losing streak or something like that. Might have even been more than that. So, you know, they're going through a rough patch in the minute, but I think the general consensus is that, like, when they get their players fit and healthy and they've got Kyrie, they're going to be, you know, obviously with the addition of Ben Simmons as well, they're going to be challenging for the championship. But we'll move on to number two. LA Rams safety Taylor Rapp proposed to his long-term girlfriend in the aftermath of his team's victory at SoFi Stadium on Sunday. Luckily, his high school sweetheart, Danielle Johnson, obliged to save any blushes. I would have loved to have seen what happened if they would have lost the Super Bowl. Like, would he have still done it?
That'd have been a nice little moment, really. Like, unlucky in sport, but lucky in love kind of vibes. I think people love that shit anyway. I remember Nigel Benn did that after one of his fights. He's like, will you marry me? I'm pretty sure Cole Fratch did that shit as well after one of his fights. It's like, bro, leave it, man.
That's a you're putting a lot of pressure on the lady there. That's a bit manipulative, I think. Now, but this high emotional moment, you've got to say yes, everyone's watching.
But to be fair, if they're elite sports people, she fucking won the lottery anyway. Do you know what I mean? She's all right. She could just divorce her, or she could just say yes and then tell you to fuck off when you get home. So I didn't want to embarrass her there. Do you know what I mean? So it's all right. It's for the moment, it's all good.
Imagine if she said no.
Knowing NFL players, you probably would have fucking chinned her there and then. Do you know what I mean? They're mad for it. They're absolutely mad for it.
They've got the best track record, have they? But I think more interestingly, Rapp also becomes the first Asian American to win a Super Bowl. His mother hails from Shanghai, China, and his old man from somewhere in Canada. But definitely a bit too young to be getting married. 24 years old. Never last, man. Never last.
Fucking hell. Pot calling the kettle black there, innit, Bissett? You're a bit young yourself.
MLS teams have been gearing up for the start of the new season later this month after last year NYCFC shocked the nation by beating Portland Timbers. I say shocked the nation, shocked like the 10% of Americans that actually watch the game. After they beat, they won in the final, although they were 22 points off New England Revolution in the Eastern Conference standings. Something I've got a massive gripe with, really. But they've had some interesting additions in the last few weeks. Check these out. Jordan Shaqiri has joined the hopeless Chicago Fire, who have been terrible for a long time, as a designated player. Douglas Costa, formerly of Bayern and currently at Juventus, has moved on loan to LA Galaxy. And apparently Carlos Tevez has been rumoured to be in talks with DC United to come and make some money in another continent. So if that don't wet your whistle, lads, and I know that I've been trying to hype up the MLS for like since this podcast started, try and catch a few games this season, man. I'm telling you, attacking football, not caring about defence, very little thought about tactics. That's what you want, man. You want some MLS.
You don't push the MLS agenda too much, man, I don't think.
It's been a while.
Yeah. You were, to be fair though, Carlos Tevez, fuck, he's one of my favourites, man. He's one of my favourites. He's absolutely sick. He's been China and back, hasn't he? He's been to Juve. He's been to City. He told United to go suck his dick, man. Got himself on a billboard. I love that geezer, you know. I think he's an absolute dancer, yeah. It's long been that place where elite players go to kind of have a little das about, have a little Sunday league vibe, and they've still got enough in their back pocket to absolutely smash the life out of the local players. So it's good value, man. I agree with what you're saying.
And they got quite an interesting system. I saw you sort of like scrunching your face up a little bit. I think it's like the top seven from each conference go through to like this little playoff. So it's kind of similar to what they do in the NFL. Do you know what I mean? So Americans being Americans, they're taking a European sport and sort of like, you know, making it their own kind of thing. Because they have to have a playoff.
Bastardizing it, yeah.
They have to have a playoff in it. They can't just be like, right, one team wins the league. Like, that's it. You play 38 games. Whoever wins, like, fairly wins it. Like, that's why New England Revolution were like 22 points ahead of everyone else and ended up getting beat. I think, who did they get beat by? I think they got beat by Portland Timbers. They didn't even get beat by NYCFC and they ended up winning it. So
I still think that all American teams across the board, all sports, they've got the best names, haven't they? The New England Revolution, the fucking Portland Timbers, mate. The New York City Cocksuckers. Love it, man.
Have you seen, you know, Washington? Obviously, Washington had to change their name because Redskins was deemed as like a racial slur. Have you seen what their new name is?
That's football team, isn't
it? It was Washington football team for a year, but they've actually got a new name now. They're called the Commanders. Washington Commanders.
Who's the owner? Fucking Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Absolutely. Oh, he had to get a shout. All right, number four. Apparently United's players are frustrated with Ralph Rangnick's squad selection methods. Which I have no idea what that could mean. Why is he like picking the players like out of a hat or something? Do you know what I mean? Well, we're just going to put all 25 of you into a hat. We're going to pick them out and then we'll just put you in the positions. But they reckon his training sessions are a bit dated. And I think the funniest thing to emerge out of this is that they keep referring to American assistant coach Chris Armas as Ted Lasso. Yanks in footy, they just can't catch a break, can they?
Can't catch a break. The I remembered him saying on one of those like after game shows where Rangnick has had a massive influence on German football, European football. But in terms of active management time over the last decade, he hasn't had that much. So I can see where his training methods, where his training sessions might be a little bit dated. Especially these are youngsters, you know what I mean? Coming through the academy, it's like cutting edge type shit. So I can see the frustration, especially when results aren't particularly going your way. They're not smashing teams, are they? So it's hard to take personal responsibility if you think the leadership isn't up to par.
And have either of you seen Ted Lasso?
Nope. Mm-mm.
Go and watch it, man. It's pretty funny. It's about like there's a fictional team called Richmond FC, which is basically Crystal Palace. And there's an American coach that has never he's never coached football. He's coached American football. He's never coached soccer. And he comes over and he knows nothing. And he brings his assistant with him who knows a little bit. And basically, the woman that hires him, she wants to fuck the club over because her husband owns it. So she hires this American guy that's got no clue about soccer, thinking he's going to be absolutely terrible. And like he is at the start, but then it turns out that he's all right. And he sort of keeps him up from getting relegated. I think last game of the season or something.
Is that a show?
Yeah, it's a show. It's a show. Yeah.
Nice character art.
It's worth a watch, man. It's pretty funny. It's Jason Sudeikis. He plays Ted Lasso, and it's got really really funny moments, man. To be fair, so it's definitely worth a watch. Puns. You'll love it, man. Like puns all the way, man. He always comes out with these amazing puns, so you'll love it.
Which one's Jason Sudeikis again?
He's the guy that's in Horrible Bosses. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I know the little fella from Always Sunny.
He turns up in an episode of that, I think, as an old mate that they want to bring back into the group, and it turns out he's schizophrenic or something.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I recognise it.
All right, number five, and this one's for you two to have a little debate over. It was on Twitter last week, and I saw it, and it sparked a sort of a Twitter heated discussion, I suppose you could call it. And somebody asked which division in the MMA was historically the toughest to dominate. And I thought initially, like, how can you even quantify it? But the floor is yours.
I reckon it's got to be the lightweight division all the way. Even though someone's dominating it now, and Oliveira, and before him, Habib was dominating it for a while. But that division is full of, they're all killers. They're all of them. You've got Gaethje, you had McGregor, you've got Poirier, Oliveira, Habib, you've got Islam Makhachev in there now. Absolute, that division is stacked. For me, I think there's no question, that lightweight division. And the fights are always good to watch.
Yeah, right now I'd say the lightweight division's indisputable, pretty much. I'd say historically, and I think, not in MMA, I think I'd be badly placed to comment on MMA as a whole. I think we're basically using MMA as shorthand for the UFC. But I'd say historically, given that there have been several long-standing champions in the division, I'd have to go with welterweight myself. If you go back to George St. Pierre, Matt Hughes, now you've got Kamaru Usman. I think there's been a succession of absolute fucking animals in there that have been repelling challenges over a long period. And it's not as if there've been mugs like coming underneath them, do you know what I mean? So I would have to go welterweight, but you could also say a similar thing about light heavyweight, John Jones, Daniel Cormier. I think they're comparable on that level. I think when there's a dominant champion, and you could say this about both, that if that champion wasn't there, there would be like 5, 6, 7 different champions in quick succession, but they're holding it down levels. So I'd say welterweight first, light heavyweight second for me. What about you, Bissett?
All I can say is I still refuse to believe that Kamaru Usman's a welterweight, man. I just look at him every time and I think, that guy must be heavier than he is. He's just cut like a god, isn't he?
They say that the more muscle you have, the easier it is to cut weight. So fats are hard things to cut. That's when you see guys with like saggy titties and that, like kind of and looking dead. But a guy like that, he's got the water on his muscles to go. So you can dehydrate and rehydrate quickly. That's why he looks like he's about fucking, he probably is about 200 pounds on fight night. Do you know what I mean? It's fucking scary, really.
I think, you know, in terms of, you know, going back to the topic of the UFC and, you know, obviously, yeah, MMA, but he basically meant UFC in it when he said that statement. I think obviously with boxing, it's clearer to see that, like, obviously generally the heavyweight division is the one that attracts the most attention in it. And that's the one that generally people love to see, the heavyweight fighters. And, you know, that's what kind of like gets their juices going. But UFC, I don't think there's any particular division, weight division, that you look at and you say that one's more high profile than others. I don't think in the, especially in the men's, I don't think, maybe in the women's, because obviously there's more limited sort of high profile stars. And obviously you can have a woman that can dominate in, I don't know, 4 or 5 weight divisions, a little bit like, you know, Canelo's done, obviously, in, you know, with the boxing and sort of like moving up and stuff. But yeah, it's difficult. I think it's very difficult to quantify, to be fair, to say historically which has been the most competitive or been the most interesting, because that's the beauty of UFC, I suppose, isn't it?
But they do a tremendous job of promoting personalities rather than specific weight categories. You know, look at McGregor, featherweight, up to lightweight. Then you've got like Stipe Miocic, didn't push him that hard. Kamaru Usman, Jorge Masvidal. They get around personas. And they, who can we push? How can we promote this fight? How do we get the gas going up? It's a little bit different in boxing, but obviously everything's in-house in the UFC. So it's one of them.
It feels like they're going by the Vince McMahon playbook to me, the way they hype up these rivalries and fights. Mate, real?
I'm telling you, man. I'm absolutely. Dana White has said, he's like, Vince McMahon's a fucking genius, basically.
And obviously, he is, yeah.
There are people that go back and forth between... Cain Velasquez was in the WWE. Brock Lesnar's gone back and forth. Do you know what I mean? Like, Ronda Rousey's gone back and forth. There are so many parallels to be taken.
CM Punk as well.
Oh, yeah.
Though he wasn't great in the MMA, but...
To be honest with you, the way he was fighting, I'd fancy my fucking chances against CM Punk.
One day of training.
One day. Minoka's are fucking killing me. I reckon he's a nunch, you know. Swear to Yeah,
but to be fair, shout out to Africa as well, man. They're absolutely dying the UFC at the minute, innit? Francis and Ghana,
you know,
Africa.
You know what? Visit. I thought he just went generally there. You know, I thought he was gonna give Toto a shout out, man. What a wicked tune. Yeah, but yeah, shout out to Africa, and that leads us nicely into the Combat Sports Review. And I'm conscious of time, so I'm gonna compress this a little bit. Just for the sake of, you know, Bissett's editing time. So we're going to get to the review. We're going to allow one championship. Sorry, lads, nothing to do with yous, but there was a big fight last week, and it was the rematch at UFC 271 between Israel Adesanya and Robert Whittaker for the middleweight title. It was a tactical affair. Adesanya dropped Whittaker in the first with the left hand, and Whittaker hit 3 or 4 takedowns, but couldn't keep the champ down for long. Adesanya threatened the Kimura a couple of times when Whittaker grappled with him up against the fence, and it worked a treat because Whittaker disengaged immediately every time he tried it. Other than these standout moments, the fight was cagey. Sorry about that pun. And Adesanya, he landed a lot of hard kicks to Whittaker's lead leg, but the challenger's movement didn't really seem compromised to me. Whittaker did a good job with his jab. And from the second round on, like in the first, he pretty much got shut down. But from the second round on, he built confidence and a bit of a rhythm with that lead punch. But that still, even though he landed it, it didn't really discourage Israel Adesanya to any great degree. A good left hook while breaking out the clinch late on certainly caught Israel Adesanya's attention, but didn't really wobble him. All in all, this was a well-matched fight that could have gone either way. And instinctively, at the end, I thought it was a draw. I thought Adesanya won rounds 1 and 3, Whittaker 4 and 5, and I couldn't really separate them in the second. So I'm not mad at the official result, but this was, I felt like this was a greater reflection of Robert Whittaker's talent than the first fight was.
This one was hyped up really well, WWE style, but I thought the actual bout itself didn't really deliver. It was tactical, but that's not what I was looking for. There was a big rivalry going on here. They were going on like, they were going to knock each other out. And they both were playing it really safe. I could see Whittaker was scared of getting knocked out again. And you can't really blame Izzy for playing it safe. He wants to keep that belt, but it just didn't deliver a very exciting fight. It was a bit too tactical. They were a bit too scared of hitting each other, it looked like. But my instinct, right as it ended, I thought Whittaker was the better man. Maybe it was just the takedowns. They didn't do much damage that I could see. He didn't really lock anything in properly. But I was leaning towards Whittaker, but I don't think it was enough for Izzy to lose the belt. So I kind of saw them giving it to Izzy in the end. But I think you were right, actually. It did feel like a draw. Quick question for you, though. So Whittaker landed a couple of takedowns. Izzy landed a few leg kicks. So they scored the same.
You know what? This is a contentious issue in terms of MMA scoring. What is a takedown worth if you don't hold the guy down? That's a massive one, because Whittaker, he hit 3 or 4 good takedowns on Israel Adesanya. And how long do you have to hold him there? Obviously, Jan Blachowicz held him there, did damage. Vettori was able to keep him there like 7+ minutes of control time. Do you get credit for dictating where the fight goes, or do you need to be threatening submissions, doing ground and pound, etc.? I would give Whittaker massive credit for hitting those takedowns, because he overcame like a really hard first round. He got dropped, but he instantly recovered. But you could see he was not in the most confident place between the space between the first and the second rounds on his stool. He managed to overcome that. And I'm cognizant of the fact that I might be giving him a little bit more credit because I watched him overcome that and start to establish his jab, start to get the left hook off, start to hit takedowns, even if he wasn't threatening submissions. I couldn't tell you how, if a leg kick is worth more than a jab, you know, if getting up is worth more than being taken down. I honestly don't know. So yeah, it was a tactical affair, not that much explosive moments. But to be fair, Adesanya was battering that lead leg, and I thought he was going to start limping around, and he didn't. He literally stuck to his gun. So I was going to say, I don't mind seeing a third fight, but if it's like that, then I ain't really that bothered.
And Jim, I've got a question for you. You probably caught the Derek Lewis, Tuivasa fight as well. For me, watching that the first round, Derek Lewis looked like he was controlling the fight, dominating. And then, you know, Tuivasa came out in that, I don't want to call it like a huge, huge forearm. Some people were saying that Derek, this was what I saw on Twitter, right? And I wanted to get your opinion on it. They were saying that Derek Lewis sometimes, he acts as if he's been hit hard to go on the ground so that he gets the opponent on the ground with him so he can grapple. I don't buy that at all. Do you?
No, not at all. He's not a grappler in any sense. His escapes from being taken down are just standing up, just being like a fucking gorilla, like no racial connotations, actually like being a strong person. But the way he went down initially, I was like, what the fuck just hit him? I didn't see what had happened. I thought, like, does he just want a way out? Because in the first round, as you say, he emptied the clip on Taito Uvasa, and I was very surprised that he didn't get knocked out, you know, even though you could see he was hurt. But on the replay, it was a massive forearm shot that put him down. It was huge. And think about it, these men are like 260, 265 pounds, and you got that weight behind you, a forearm slash elbow coming into the side of your jaw. And bear in mind, that was the final strike in a sequence of hard strikes. And when I seen that, I was like, oh, yeah, fair enough. Fair enough, man. The first one would have got me out of there. So, no, I don't think he was playing possum at all. I think he was genuinely hurt. And I also think he was quite tired, because Lewis went after him in that first round, as you say. I was shocked by that result. I thought Lewis was going to get the win there, but fair play to Ty. At the same time, he has similar limitations to Derek Lewis. If he fights someone like Cyril Gane, he's fucked. If he fights Ngannou, he's fucked. But this is what the game's about. You got to go prove yourself and try, isn't it? It's not really about my preconceptions of what's going to happen in the fight. It's about getting him up there and let's see what can happen. He's basically undersized as a heavyweight as well. But should we just move on to Kell Brook, Amir Khan? That sound good?
Yeah, man.
Let's do it.
All right. So this weekend, actually, not even this weekend, it's tonight, isn't it? In a couple of hours' time. The card's going to start in about 3-4 hours. I'm not watching the whole thing. The whole card looks like shit, man. The main event is what I'm really interested in. This is a fight that may legitimately be taking place 10 years too late. But that also means it's 10 years in the making. And the closer this fight has got, the anticipation for me has been building. And especially when I've been talking to like Joe Barr in the chat, like Pizzy, Tino, like we're actually gassed, man. So let's just go through the particulars. It's been made at £149, and that's £2 above the welterweight limit. Should either fighter come in above that weight, they'll be fined £100,000 for every pound they're over. Now, as we sit here now, they both made weight. I seen them yesterday on the scales. But that's an interesting stipulation to have for a non-title bout. And you can see they've been pecking away at each other in the negotiation process. Both Brook and Khan have been shown levels by Terence Crawford in the last 2 years. But I think they're actually declining an equal gradient. Now, I like Brook in this fight. Contrary to popular belief, I don't think Amir Khan has a bad chin. I think he's got serious defensive shortcomings that have got more apparent since his hands have started to slow down. His speed, I think, will still be a problem for Brook early on. But unless Brook's durability has completely vanished, which, judging from the Crawford fight, might well be the case, I can see Brook bringing Khan's hands down with a body shot and winging one over the top and getting him out of there. Brook's back with his old trainer, Dominic Ingle, which is a very good sign. He never looks half as good when he strays to other trainers. Khan's actually training with Terence Crawford, with Bomac, the guy who last beat him, which is another interesting development as to what's going on. Now, does this mean that Khan will have a few new tricks up his sleeve? Maybe. Personally, I don't see it. And I might change my mind, like once I see the final developments leading up to the fight. But I'm going Brook by KO. So obviously, bet the house on Khan, innit? So it's I want to get your opinions on it. I don't know how much of the build-up you've been watching, but this I'm actually gassed for this one. Now we're about 4 or 5 hours away from the first bell.
I think the roadmap for this fight seems relatively clear, doesn't it? So I think the general consensus is that perhaps Khan's going to come out, you know, all guns blazing, hopefully show some of that fantastic speed that we saw throughout his career. And then maybe if, you know, Brook can get, you know, can sort of like deal with him for those early rounds, 3, 4, 5, then he's going to get into the fight. He's going to grow into the fight. And in the latter stages of the fight, potentially, if he can get one of those, like an overhand right that we saw Khan, you know, being punished by, quite a few times in his career, then perhaps you're going to look at Brook in the sort of like 7 to 9. I do like Brook in round 7, 8 or 9 to win the fight. But if Khan can sort of roll back the years to anything we've saw, you know, in the past, the Maidana fight that sticks out in my memory. If he can roll back those years, and I know Jim, you're going to have a few things to say about that. But I was watching back that fight, man. That is, if we can see anything like that, this is going to be a huge spectacle, man. It's going to be a really, really great fight to watch. So I'm starting to get a little bit gassed about it now as well.
You know, with the Maidana fight, probably his career best performance. And I got no bones about it, man. He was fucking 100% on the steads in that fight, man. He's in Manny Pacquiao's camp for that fight. Alex Ariza, known drug cheat, man. Pacquiao, my favorite fighter of all time. Steadhead, I don't care what anyone says. You cannot move up 8 divisions, retain your muscle mass, retain your spit. I'm not having it, man. I am not fucking having it. So all of a sudden, Khan develops a chin when he goes there. He got knocked down by Willie Limond for the British title. Got cleaned out by Brady Prescott on his first... Do you know what I'm saying? Let's fucking have it right. Come on. This is the fucking truth. And for me, you know my stance. I think all fighters, all athletes should be able to take whatever they want to get the best performance out of themselves. I'm just saying that he was 100% on the steads for that fight. Can he replicate that form? Maybe. How long will it last? Not long. If Khan wins this fight, I think it's rounds 1, 2, and 3. Because I think even now, age 35, 34, 35, his speed is a real fucking problem.
But Jim, is the speed with, I don't think anyone's ever had a question with, you know what I mean? That's always been one of, you know, one of the marquee sort of areas of his game. But is the lack of power a problem? And will that be a problem against Brook?
Steads have come a long way. I reckon he's going to have crazy power.
Now, you know, it's not really, I don't think like steroids or performance enhancing drugs create power. It's about your endurance and your recovery time and about able to go again. I definitely think they help your durability, but I think his speed is the problem. I genuinely do, because when you see him let both hands go and he's in full flurry mode, that is an overwhelming situation to be in. But the other side of that coin is he commits to his attacks so wholeheartedly that some fighters, i.e. Danny Garcia, to name like probably the best example, Canelo, they're able to sit there in the pocket and wait for the storm to blow over them. And then they just wing one in. And Khan's hands are all the way out here and there's all this space. And I can see that happening, but I can also see Brook, if he's as diminished as the Khan camp are hoping, I can see him kind of like, fucking hell, I don't know what's going on here. And like taking a knee in the second, maybe. I can see something like that happening.
I think, was it Carlos Molina? I think it might have been after that, the two defeats he had. Was it Danny Garcia you just mentioned? And then who was you? Was it Peterson?
Lamont Peterson, but that was contentious, you know. That was contentious.
And then Molina, I think in the latter rounds of that fight, he basically had the win, like, there. Like, and it was very similar to what you were saying. It seemed like Khan emptied all his energy in the early rounds. And then Molina was, like, starting to pick him off. And then obviously, you know, he went all wobbly legs again. But he ended up just getting over the line in that fight, if I remember.
And that was a 10-rounder, I think, as well. If that went 11 or 12, if I remember correctly, yeah, that's the way. Listen, this is why Amir Khan's so exciting. I'm a big fan of Amir Khan. And I'll put it on the table right now. I think a lot of people don't like him, just his Asian in it. I actually think that's the truth. I think he's one of the most exciting, one of the bravest fighters I've ever seen in my life. There's never a fight he's going to turn down. Never. He went in against Canelo. He moved up two fucking weight classes to fight Canelo, man. Do you know what I'm saying? This is a Don right here. He's just got certain defensive frailties that could bite him in the arse in his fight. But I also think Brook has got certain frailties. I think if you have both eye sockets reconstructed, I think you're in a bit of trouble if you're in a boxing ring. And if Khan can let off like some like 10-punch combination on you, you might just instinctively go, fuck this. Do you know what I mean?
What's the verdict for the listeners? The listeners want to know. They're waiting with bated breath, Jim.
They're not going to be able to hear it because it's going to be after, like, we're going to edit, you know, it's going to be finished.
Yeah.
But do it anyway.
Listen, I'll say one last caveat, and I've got a pick, but I think a troubling thing for Brock is that he seems way more emotionally involved in his fight than Khan does. Khan looks like he believes he's the better fighter, and Brock looks like he wants to smash his face in. And I don't think those emotions help. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but that's my take. My pick is Brook by knockout. I think he's going to get in there. I think he's got enough left in the tank. What about
so
you
heard
two?
That correctly, everyone. Vote for Khan.
Yeah, yeah. But
put all the exactly, money on Khan.
As I'm saying, put your house on Khan, mate. I'm
any particular rounds? You're gonna hazard a round?
I don't like picking rounds, man. If Khan gets it, I think he'll get it early. If Brook gets it, five onwards. But not a specific round for me.
Fair enough. That's a wrap then, isn't it?
I believe so. What do you guys think anyway? No, you can't just put me on the spot. What do you two think?
I'm going to go with you. Yeah, well, I'll go for
yeah. Nah, lead it.
Brook
lead
7-9. That's what I'm going to have a bet on. 11-2. Brook in round 7-9. 7-9 knockout. 11-2. 20 quid.
I'm very, very interested in Khan's new tricks. So I might swing to say Khan. Let's say early-ish knockout. Like round five knockout from Khan.
Training with Crawford. The best welterweight on the planet right now is not going to hurt you. That's all I'm going to say, man. If he's able to undo some of the bad habits he's developed over a lifetime of boxing, I'll be very fucking impressed. You know what I'm saying? But I also think that in the heat of the moment, under the bright lights, it was the heat of the moment. I think you revert to type under those situations, you know? So, yeah, I'm going to go for Brook.
And he's a 4-7 favorite. So, yeah, quite a significant favorite. Amir Khan's 11-8. The draw, and I think Tino brought this up interestingly in the group earlier. The draw's 18-1 when, you know, in fights of this nature, usually the draw is probably around, what, 33 to 1 when the tie is quite close. So I think they're kind of leaning towards the fact that a draw might be an actual possibility. And to be fair, let's face it, this is going to be these two fighters' last fight, isn't it? I don't think either of them are going to have a fight after this. So what if this is a great fight, goes 12 rounds, you know?
Rematch,
you know what I mean? Why not?
Yeah.
But the thing is, I was going to say this as well. I forgot to say it to you earlier. I can see a controversial early kind of stoppage either way so they can build up the next one Vince McMahon style, you know? Like, you know, like Frotch Groves, that kind of shit. That was the most anticipated rematch I can fucking remember because of the stoppage. I could definitely see something like that happening. If one of the fighters is under heavy weather and they just call it, but it shouldn't have really been called, I could definitely see something like that happening. The draw equally as well.
Right. So that fight's going to be on in what?
What
is it? 10 o'clock ring walk, is it? 10:30, something like that?
I'm going to be trying to find a completely legal stream about half nine. About half nine, I'll be on. Because Natasha Jonas is fighting for the world title.
Oh, is she? Okay, so what else is on the undercard?
Oh, that undercard's dog shit, man. I watched Natasha Jonas, but other than that, I'm not interested.
Yeah, who was it? She was impressive against,
what's her name? Is it Terry Harper?
No, who was it?
I think it was Terry Harper, you know.
Yeah, the last time I watched her, she was good to watch. It was one of the big guns. One of the high profile female boxers. Not Savannah Marshall, no.
No, they're worlds apart in weight. Yeah. It weren't Chantel Cameron. I'm
not Katie Taylor?
I don't think so.
I think it might have. It was one of the high profile women fighters anyway, but let's call it a day there. Then I'll probably start editing now, to be fair.
Good man, but
get a jump on it.
Get
it out before the fight. Jesus. Oh, that's a task. That is
not just sure Saturday, man. Let me chill. I'll be happy. Sound
cool.
We'll see what happens. All right, sound boys.
A pleasure as always.
Cheers, lads. Yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah. See you later, boys.
Oh, well.